where you have that intervention called performance management, it should be learning led. It should be development and growth led. It should be, because I go back to that belief system that says, well, look, that person's turned up in your organization, bursting out of the seams to do the very best job they can.
Hello, and you're very welcome to episode 4 of Leadership Discoveries. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce Barry Flack, fractional HR executive, venture capital and private equity people consultant, HR tech advisor, keynote speaker. The list could go on and on. Barry, you've got a very extensive portfolio behind you. You're very welcome here today.
Thank you very much, Shirley. Great to be here. And you're absolutely right. I have not found a business card big enough to stick all that onto at the moment.
Barry, I don't think you would be offended if I called you a disruptor. And it didn't surprise me when the first time I came across the phrase fractional executive was actually from yourself. And it piqued my interest. And I know it has piqued the interest of a lot of other people that I know as well. Can you tell the listeners what is a fractional executive?
The phrase for me came after actually doing the work, as is often the case on this. What we now call a fractional executive since late 2018. What does it mean? Look, it means that we are now getting the evolution of freelancing, slightly, if not much more niche. And it's a niche offering at the C-suite executive level, where you get, as a leader, as a CEO and a business owner, the opportunity to bring in, hire on demand, an individual who can provide to you the level of both strategic input, doing, you know, grabbing your organization through the gears at any of the sort of disciplines that we've come to know in that C-suite area, and offer up an alternative to a slightly one-dimensional view, especially in the SME, startup, scale-up market. So I do this over a variety of clients. The on-demand means you can scale me up and down depending on the want and the need. And you can exit me at the point when the want isn't there anymore. And it offers, look, from a business case perspective, the level of experience that was previously out of reach and the expertise that was out of reach, the cost price that doesn't cover all of that overhead that we put an associate with a permanent hire.
So is it the same or is it different to an interim role?
The answer to that is it's different. Interim would be a very clear and obvious lines of engagement. Yeah, come in, you know, be here for 9 months. You're replacing somebody who may not be around, or it's a stopgap until we hire somebody. This, so for example, a few of my assignments have run for 3 to 4 years. You know, I work embedded inside the organization. I'll work with them typically on a cadence of 1-2 days a week. I'll operate as the person who obsesses about people and culture. I'll deliver against that very much part-time, very much embedded into the organization, but very much at a commercial basis that makes sense for leaders and founders, you know, who are still bootstrapping and who are still now getting expertise at a cost they can afford.
And I know your particular interest and expertise is in this people and culture piece, but is fractional executives, it's in any C-suite domain, you're saying? It can be marketing, presumably, it can be anywhere.
There's an increasing level of supply that, as you rightfully say, you know, I think some of the forerunners have been the finance folk. Marketing folk makes, you know, eminent sense around the type of work that they would do around campaigns, the sort of marketing activities that any younger business would require, product, CTO, and then look, the emergence certainly in a couple of businesses of CEOs on a fractional basis.
Okay.
Certain founders that, you know, are working on this, not on a full-time basis, but on a part-time basis where, like, you know, the hands-off might be at a holding level or with a chairman or something else. It certainly offers to those, I think, who've got the experience, the emotional intelligence, the breadth of skills to come in and, you know, quite simply take an agenda and accelerate it quickly. and are expected to do so, and that's the difference. There's none of this come bed yourself in, spend 100 days, get to know us. I mean, it is a clear and obvious line of sight, outcomes, deliver, do it now.
And what type of organizations then is it best suited to, Barry, do you think, or does it matter?
It's certainly most valuable to those in that startup scale-up world. It's an alternative to picking, certainly in my tribe, a relatively inexperienced first jobbing HR people operations person that you would hire on a permanent basis. So the obvious piece there is that the commercials allow you to have that person guide you through the initial stages of growth around 10, 15, 20, up to 50. I mean, the obvious time when it clearly drops away is when that volume, from an employee perspective, may change. So if you're really into that sort of 75, 100, 150, look, I've done work with those, but you are starting to strain the commercials by saying, look, this is 3, this is maybe 4 days, just given the sort of breadth of it. But undoubtedly, this type of service was out of reach, historically, and it's been a period of education to leaders and founders to understand that there's an alternative, because clearly at those stages of organization, it's all about growth and it's all about what I would call cultural infrastructure and systems and setting up and moving from the scrappy bootstrapping to a slightly more process type organization without losing the secret sauce. That's not an easy agenda for somebody on their first people ops HR role to get around the politics, to get around the capabilities, the decision making of that big agenda.
Absolutely. And it sounds like we're talking about very sophisticated stakeholder management skills because it's not easy, some of the things you're talking about. Because presumably, Barry, you are, or are you, in a sense, holding the leadership team accountable as well for many of the areas that you're talking about, in terms of their activities or in terms of what they're committing to?
Yeah, look, it is absolutely that the responsibility of working with them on that time, and that time is honor bound, is about setting in the infrastructure, the framework to allow them to go off and be successful. So you get to play in the sorts of rituals and habits that's going to work. You're going to put those in place and get their confidence levels up. Train them, make sure they understand it. But the very obvious return on investment here is you're not sitting around doing it for them 3.5, 4 days a week. You're very much an intervention that they see value in. And then you're running with it. And that is also a very clear and obvious no hiding place to making sure that the outcomes you produce for these type of organizations have to hit the spot every time. That's challenging, but if you have the right underpinning process around testing something and having the evidence and putting it in and creating a prototype and letting them run with it and then setting the scene that you're coming back to review it and that it's effective, that tends to treat them like the adults they are. If you know that overall they want to develop their people or they want to drive times 10 performance in a particular area.
There's loads of things I want to ask you, Barry, I have to say, but I think if we move on from this whole fractional executive piece into another world that I know you're very experienced in, you probably, first of all, I have to say, are probably one of the most commercially focused HR stroke feature people and culture pe person people I've ever come across. But when one of the things you talk about is in the world of HR, you talk about removing some of the old rituals, creating value for clients. I'm really interested to know from your perspective, and for HR people who could be listening to this podcast as well, not just business leaders, what has moved on and what still needs to change for the role of HR, stroke, people and culture, whatever we want to call it, within organisations?
This is a subject that both I love dealing with, but frustrates the life out of me. And I say that because the context to why we should behave like this is about 50 years old now. We are and have been, and my career has been dominated by an era of complexity. Our way of understanding the world of work changed decades ago into a place where this complexity dictates two things for HR people and business leaders to consider, and that is that we cannot predict the market and we cannot predict people. If you've got those values or, optics in front of you can start clearly establishing that you've got people in your organization who want to do good, that they want to come, they want to do a good job, that they are not, as our predecessors were obsessed with, there to steal from the till or do ill or do evil. And so with a level of frustration, those 40, 50 years is still seen a very clinging predominance to the old command and control, the steering of the leadership team as it's projected. And that leadership team as it's projected is too often about leaders and followers. And the challenge being that if you're a consenting adult, nobody wants to be a follower. Yeah, we want very different things. We want stewardship from that leadership community. And then the element of success factor inside the organization is about a sort of minimum viable product. It's about making sure that those people you've hired and hired well have a true understanding of what good looks like, that you give them what it needs to be successful, and you let them get on with it. And you flip from some of those things that you've asked about, which we obsessed about. We have previously performance and I'm going to fire you. Most famously shown by the Jack Welch philosophy and the bottom 10% to where we need to be, which is very much I'm going to help you grow and help you learn and understand that I will get more from you if I can continue to coach and continue to lead you through these things. And so we have the toxic smell of lots of old command and control stuff that still hangs around and performance management systems or the way we perceive management leadership and whether it's helpful or hinders, a whole variety of stuff. It's most famously shown, I think, at the moment by that whole debate in the knowledge worker space around presenteeism, hybrid, remote. Do I need to see you? If you want to really understand the conundrum we're in, have a look at that sort of debate that's going on there, which is very nuanced, where we haven't landed, but is still filled with far too much about only being productive, only being valuable is you sitting in front of me. I need to see you. So we've got to challenge behaviors like that, and we've got to find and iterate and put in place the sort of democratic interventions in organizations that free people up.
And I have to ask you, because you've mentioned performance management, where do you sit in relation to this debate? What does good performance management look like to you? How should it be done?
Yeah, look, for me, and I've happily, thankfully, I think, worked with a few organizations who've seen this. Once again, premise, problem we're trying to solve here is to get the very best of the people that are in our organization. And so where you have that intervention called performance management, it should be learning led, it should be development and growth led. It should be because I go back to that belief system that says, well, look, that person's turned up in your organization, bursting out of the seams to do the very best job they can. And with that wonderful premise, why don't we help them? Because the return on investment for you and the business is manifold. Yeah. If I want to constrict them, restrict them, teach them to work like a child and be supervised, to run fearfully, to have all of those toxic pieces. We know enough about emerging neuroscience to tell you that that is some of the worst thing you can do to the performance levels of people. So, this has to be about on the front foot, adult conversations with capable individuals who get an awful lot of self-satisfaction from achievement at work. And they want to do that. I don't think we talk enough about that, but that ability to just say, I've done a really good job and I've enjoyed doing a really good job. And are we having the sort of relationship that steps into those type of conversations and interventions? And too often we don't, and we get distracted by the fallout of that, which is that people leave managers, yeah, or people underperform or quiet quitting or any other thing that we put the word in front of, emerges as a trend. But that's on the premise that we don't trust these people, and we've got to stop that.
When you look at people that you've actually come across that you say they've got this, they're doing it right, what are you seeing? What does a good manager, a good leader in this space look like to some of the points that you've just talked about there?
I wrote about something like this on LinkedIn this morning, but for founders, for any leaders that I would respect, they've got two things to guard against, and that is the trick of stability and agility. So there is still a requirement along leaders to provide what I call stewardship. The ability to provide a level of confidence and safety that they are guarding the organization as it moves forward. They're taking away that bottom of the Maslow hierarchy of just allowing the person to realize that they can be absolutely brilliant without fear. And we're getting a bit of that in the AI debate, in terms of where leaders need to be responding to. And then, of course, the other thing, which is incredibly important that everybody gets, is the agility piece. So in that commercial outcome that if we don't have a business and we don't have profit, you and I can't sit here and talk about all the interesting stuff. So that's your absolute need, is to go there and create that profit. Well, how do we get people inspired to use their brain at the local level, to make empowering decisions, to create the right level of innovation, to, be a good colleague? And so the very best leaders are more comfortable in a principle-led approach where they will guard and steward away and saying that these are the ingredients, the secret sauce of my organization that have been important to date, that I hold true to. And I want those sorts of things to guard your decision-making process. So this isn't here's the policy book, here's the handbook, go read 64 pages. This is the wonderful example of Southwest Airlines many, many years ago of providing the budget to the customer service rep to do good on the desk, when they see fit, $2,000 for the crying child who's lost a teddy, that they go and buy a new one because it creates enormous value. So we've got that tension. Funnily enough, in that particular scenario, Southwest Airways had to actually peel back on the stability piece from an efficiency perspective. But that's okay. But the very best are the ones that are asking themselves the constant question of where to sit, what's the trade-off, where do I need to play? And having enough self-awareness that being in and over really good people doing their job is instinctively a not a good place to be.
I mean, I love that stability and agility. I'm sure there are people listening to that and saying, well, how on earth do I actually create that? Because it is quite nuanced, but how do you build that in leaders? Because I mean, that is about confidence, isn't it? Is it about confidence building? Is it about letting them have their opportunity? How do you create leaders who are like that in an organization? I'm wondering.
Look, we need to do it at scale. I think part of the problem we have is we've got far too many bodies of people out there who aren't creating this, who are creating an overblown, slightly outdated view of what a leader should be, going back to that issue of followership or whatever. But I mean, look, I think this is about, once again, if we can start building some of those principles that run successful organizations, everybody will have their own version of it. If we're in that complex world that we've talked about, and you've accepted it, and you've accepted that people are good, then I think we're starting to create humble, really good business leaders who are in a place where they want to create really good enterprises rather than being the one that's the center of attention, the one that needs to be there in the detail, that needs to be the smartest individual in the room, et cetera, et cetera. Gives way to mastery to individuals who just don't have the historic job title. Look, the interesting thing is we've had organizations, some of which are about 70 odd years old, who follow this principle. I think of one of those prime examples is W.L. Gore. He has held an incredibly strong principled approach that has flown through to absolutely every decision that business makes in relation to working the Gore way. Leaders in that organization are constantly appraised by the people around them. They emerge, they put an awful lot of emphasis on the right way of doing things. They have a very strong sense of hiring people with adaptability. that can, this is a major issue in complexity, is that if you're not bouncing forward in this weird world that we can't see anything coming at us, that's going to be a limiting factor for your business. The organizations that are able to create opportunity out of adversity by liberating individuals to do so, are the ones that are going to win in this age of complexity. Our friends, you either love or hate, you're a wonderful example of that, are Amazon, who just constantly create lines of business and ways of doing things out of the disruption that's hitting everybody else. So we need more of those leading organizations. But I think, to be honest, Shirley, I think everything comes back to what's your belief system? What is your limiting factors? And with a lot of leaders I deal with, are they willing to change? That bit that goes, what you're doing, that you're firmly a believer in, it limits people here. It's self-defeating, it's self-harming, because you want your business to grow. You want these people to do more and better. But what you're doing to them is the complete opposite. It's control, it's steer, it's adult child. It's a place they go to. And it's complex, but it is ultimately self-harming.
Do you have any messages to founder-led businesses? I know you work with a lot of founders, but particularly what you're describing there, for instance, there is that desire to hold on to this thing that you've created. And are there any messages you have for founders like that? How do we get to the place that you're actually talking about there in terms of that freedom, in terms of that belief system?
The answer is, what got us here doesn't get us there, is the ultimate takeaway on that. The core skill that you're going to need from a founder's perspective is adaptability. So there is a wonderful heroic story that I think every founder always goes to, and it's the sitting around the dining room table or sitting in the garage if you're an American. But it is that wonderful energy of like-minded individuals building the initial prototype and going to market and making the first million and all of that great heroic story. And then scaling, in many respects, from a people perspective, is how you adapt in relation to the numbers game. So at 25, everything breaks. At 40, 50, you're literally hiring leaders who are strangers to come and take some of the slack from you. At 150, you've hit Dunbar and you're out cognitively of the people that you can just build a relationship with. The very best leaders are obsessive as much about people as they are about product and market, on what it means for them as they go through those changes. The ones where it's a struggle are the ones who are still sitting in the garage, clinging to bootstrapping as a virtue, not paying enough attention to some of the core cultural interventions like hiring properly and setting principles and creating values, and have a hodgepodge of people that they're just frankly at war with, and then it becomes a place where they're still stuck in a mindset that is back in the days when it's been outdated now. So the messaging has got to be about adaptability, and with adaptability comes a degree of humility. You got to be humble on these things as you move forward.
And as you're talking there, Barry, I'm thinking probably what you need to do as well is you need to invite someone in, don't you, to challenge your way of thinking, to actually put on the table some of the things that you've been talking about here.
Oh, without a shadow of a doubt. The idea that you've got people who are mentors, people that you can rely upon, people that will take you on that. Not enough founders do that. Their focus is sales, their focus is business development, their focus is lots of other things, but it's not about culture, and sometimes too late, sometimes far too late.
Can we just turn to technology? We've worked together in the past, and certainly that's been something that you have been very much an advocate of, going back a long, long time, I have to say. And you mentioned artificial intelligence. When you look forward and when you look at leaders now, what is it they need to have to actually be able to exist in this world? Because I do think it is challenging for some leaders who don't know enough about it. Maybe they don't need to know enough about it, as in deep expertise. What are your views, Barry, in relation to that?
Yeah, look, I mean, you're absolutely right. This feels like another wave of technology transformation, and here we come. I think The message to leaders at this particular point is, look, if you did a SWOT analysis, the balance story is that clearly you'd have enough content in each one of those strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. Yeah. There's a very polarized debate and there's a lot of noise that leaders are clearly going with. But there is something rapid and seismic about AI and Gen AI and robotics and the capabilities that run with it. So the measured 2024 takeaway on this is get to understand what it means for your organization and in relation to productivity around how you do things. So join the conversation, put somebody in charge if you're off that scale, or get interested yourself. But there is a very clear and obvious need that says operationally I'm doing my work. I really do need to be inside this tent. I mean, it does feel seismic. It is a bit immature and there's lots of nuance around it. But I think the better leaders would also go with a second piece of advice, of course, which is that the better ones should develop a bit of a sort of human-centered approach to what the response happens to be. So, you know, if I go back to that word we used earlier around stewardship, there is a need for people who are hearing the noise to have some type of dialogue around threat. Yeah. Am I losing my job? Yeah. I mean, that's probably the number one search item across Google, or any other platform in relation to what does this thing mean? And of course, as an AI optimist, who gets to play around with this stuff and who gets to meet people who call themselves futurists and get terribly excited. There is some wonderful rapid deployment of this stuff that, frankly, for me and for the leaders, goes after tedious. I mean, the meeting culture with AI smattered all over it now is a joy to behold. No longer do you need to write minutes. No longer do you need to find the actions. You know, the assistance, the development of an AI generative assistant for individuals, freelancers, for people in business is brilliant. You know, it's rapidly evolving into a new level of Alexa conversation where if you open up, you know, your own access to it, it's starting to do the tedious for you. It's starting to cancel stuff. It's booking stuff. It's doing stuff for you. So there's, you know, there's utility that's going to grow and the computing power will get greater and better, but it's immature. You know, it's still an 80-20. It's still dear ChatGPT, draft me an article, still requires the human eye and it still requires an element of editing. You know, so there's a two-pronged get involved, work with a HR person, get a real sense of what it means when you overlay it into your organizational problem, appreciate the ethical and human issues that exist on it, and recognize that, you know, your team, your business, they want to hear from you about it. They want to know what it means, you know, working in this firm this year and next.
Barry, one of the areas that you're involved in is interacting with private equity, interacting with venture capitalists. And I'm just wondering, when people think about that, and particularly when people who are in the, let's say, HR people management function, there is a sense that this is a transaction, and the transaction will have a limited amount of time, it'll end, and we'll all move on. Just in your work with those types of firms, PE firms, what would you be advising them to look for? You know, what are you asking them to focus on when it comes to the people agenda within organizations that they've bought?
I've had the pleasure of being inside the PE and VC firm, looking after them, being the HR person for them, and I've also had the pleasure on the portfolio companies piece. So, you know, look, I think the observations are correct. PE VC firms probably 5 to 7 years ago were actually primarily about capital with a seat on the board. And that capital was typically what drove them. There wasn't really much more in the value creation piece. And then we went into what I think lots of others would probably see, which is a sort of an ex-executive search person became a talent partner because a real obvious focus was the board. And to be honest, that surface level, this organization is performing on track because of the people who sit around that board meeting. Yeah. And I think, look, clearly and obviously, we've got a bit deeper now. We've got obviously India point of realizing that the complexity of that organization requires the private equity and VC firms to have capabilities in place and a focus in place that looks at culture. That looks at culture in a very specific way. So let's not kid ourselves. They are very obviously tuned up to, profitability, to innovation, looking at savings in and around that particular enterprise. But they are cognizant of the fact that that is and needs to be done, with due course to an organization that needs to keep on track. Transactions giving away, the understanding and the debate around that boardroom table when you put analytical, capability underpinning it, and you get to really understand the true drivers of value creation for them, over and above the, is the arrow going in the right direction at the right speed, is clearly there. And so, I think for people interested in working in that space, it is very much about proving your spurs in the areas that I've mentioned, growth, hyper growth. What does that mean? Working in terms of being able to influence a business in that wonderful place of cleansing. And we mentioned earlier in the conversation that a lot of that cleansing is due to old-fashioned, outdated cultural systems that hold people back. So there's a sort of rapid deployment of the right stuff that feels probably a bit transactional, but certainly less so than has been historically.
And are we using data enough in terms of people? Have we moved on in terms of the connection between the hard analytics and some of the softer people pieces? Have we got those two connected yet, do you think?
But look, at scale, no, but I'm desperately chasing a very high bar. I've seen the business case. The point solutions and the HCM systems out there won't get away with selling product nowadays without having analytical capability in it. And that analytical capability has moved massively to an analytical piece that's about, predictive. But it throws up a level of questioning the HR functions about the data that they have, and about the belief they have in terms of using that. Because, and I've had examples of that recently, we're still very much about the quick solution, the easy solution that isn't underpinned by the right level of evidence. To tie an earlier question, I still see annual surveys inside employee bases having far too much emphasis. That snapshot dictates the second half of the year of too many HR functions. And so if that is signal, do we understand what the root cause is? Do we understand the evidence underpinning the investment we'll make and the action we'll take? My instinct is no, not enough, because our propensity is action. They're unhappy about this. We must do that. Is that really what they're saying? So, across business, across HR, we need to raise the level of debate to a point where it's not just about I gutturally think this is what they do. If you sit back at a board meeting, you'll hear lots of people say that, basing decisions on a conversation they had with three people. They're like this, and this is how they feel. So we've got to get better at that, because it's an unforgiving place that when we're off and we're running and we've invested and we're hoping for a return and we don't get it, we're in the blame then, aren't we?
For the business people who are sitting, listening to this conversation now, what conversations or what questions should they be asking of their HR folk? What should they be focusing on?
It's a really good question. I think the issue that we're all bouncing about with at the moment, there's got to be a question about capabilities. So certainly on this side of of the pond, it's cut back and it's recessionary and it's a few outliers in industries, but ultimately, we're going through a refocus in terms of what the organization will look and feel like, coming out the other end. We've had in the post, I think of it for an awful long time, which is now being realized, talent scarcity. And that's beginning to move beyond blaming talent acquisition for. We've got an internal population that we know now, I think maturely, that if we start letting them go, we might not get them back in the same sort of scale. And we've got within that talent scarcity element around capabilities, the question about adjacency. If I can't find enough people with this type of skill set, what is the person sitting next to them look and feel like? We've just spoken about the technology enablement and what that brings. And, there's a lot of organizations, as an anecdote, who are not bringing back recruitment people in measured growth terms. They're going to augmented services around RPO and others to manage that flow whilst they understand what they want to hold on to and what they don't. And, we've come out of a period where hyper growth, I think, is now a bit of a dirty word, where we've overhired, and we're still seeing it in big tech companies everywhere, where we're cutting back because starting the equation from lots of people dictating a market number seems to have disappeared, from those who value organizations. The sort of revenue per employee, is much more of an indicator. And you get a better revenue per employee if you have lesser employees. So I think capabilities has got to be in there. I think if the other aspect is, several years of buffering for their people, call it burnout, that understanding of burnout, call it our responses to burnout. And I think we've had a very interesting anecdote recently where an initial response was increasing individual wellness. So an incredible amount of focus on how we would step into helping people deal with mental health, with other types of health issues. I think we've taken, and I don't think this should come as a bit of a surprise, a bit of a knocking recently, with the anecdote or the evidence that suggests that actually that doesn't do anything for organizational growth. And that makes sense to me because if you're not tackling the system that creates burnout, no amount of tampering around the individual problem area is going to change that. And I think that's what we ended up finding, that the conflict between the I now need you on the 8 o'clock call to I've a gym class booked and I'm not moving it is actually causing 10 times the stress levels inside the employee base. So we, once again, I think we need to calibrate with this issue of evidence and back to the HR people, back to the business. We need to work on the system, not in it, to just sort of, create short-term, sticking plasters over some large crevices here. We've got a productivity issue, and throwing more hours at it and the cognitive overload that goes with it is, is problematic. It's not working, and it's counterintuitive for lots of people who are surviving as business leaders when it comes to profitability.
It's a really good point, unfortunately, to close this conversation, Barry. As I said, there's 100 more questions I could ask you. And when we were talking just before we went live here, we were saying, let's see where this conversation goes. And it's gone in many different directions, but lots of very interesting insights. Thank you so much, Barry. It's absolutely been a pleasure, as it always is. Very challenging. I'm going to have to go away now and think about some of these things in a little bit more detail. But thank you very much indeed. A pleasure, Barry.
Thank you very much, Shirley.
And I want to thank you, our listeners, too. I suspect you've come from very different parts of the globe and from within different industries also. And I hope that you have found the discussion as insightful and as thought-provoking as I did. By the way, if you'd like to contact me, you can do that on LinkedIn or on shirleycavanagh.com. To our listeners, I hope this has been as useful to you as it has been for me.